The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast, brought to you by Underdog Fantasy and Fantrax. I'm your host, James Anderson, and this week's guest, or this today's guest, is Rob Silver, 2016 NFBC Main Event overall winner, co-host of the Launch Angle Podcast. Rob is my third former main event winner of the offseason to grace me with his presence, so really appreciate that. Rob, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I was excited to do this, James. We had a lot of fun last year, so this hopefully will live up to last year's pod.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun last year, and I wanted to sort of start with starting pitching kind of near the top in general, just because I just kind of wanted to see where the conversation might go, because one of your best calls from last year's pod was kind of equating Justin Verlander to Max Scherzer. And if you followed Rob's advice on that one, you got a SP1 in the sixth round or whatever. So really good stuff. The guy who I keep focusing on, at least in the past few weeks, has been Carlos Rodon, just because I think it's interesting to me how the market seems to still be pretty skeptical on him relative to recent track record and projections. And I look at a lot of the starting pitchers going in the top 15, and I don't see a case for why Rodon is more risky than about half of them. And if every projection is saying this guy's a top three starting pitcher, and he's still got the ninth ADP in recent DCs among starting pitchers, I'm just kind of curious on your take as to, you know, why should we be still concerned about Rodon's durability, especially relative to some of these other guys? I mean, what's the case for not taking Rodon as a top pitcher?
You know, James, when you sent me the outline and I saw the Rodon section, I cursed under my breath, because I don't lie on podcasts. I would never lie just because I like somebody or don't like somebody. And I bet a bunch of people are about to curse us. So I think there's a pretty clear top four in starting pitching this year. The two that everybody thinks are, I think Burns and Cole are 1-2, both because of track record as well as ridiculous skills. Despite Cole's home run issues last year, he's still ridiculously good. And then the other two who are not consensus is I have Rodon number three and I have Strider number four. And I think you can flip them around. I think you can flip all four of those around and make an argument. Depends how much you, how you want to weight innings, you can make a case for all four. But I absolutely agree. I think Carlos Rodon is skills wise every bit as good as every pitcher other than Jacob deGrom, who we'll talk about in a second, but he's right there. It's you are nitpicking when you're starting to split the differences between him and the other three guys on the list. So then it's a volume question. And I agree with the premise, which is there still injury risk with Rodon that's probably, if we're being honest, a little bit higher elevated than Cole or Burns? Certainly not higher than Strider. Is it overstated in terms of the projections for innings in the public projections that do love him? I think it probably is, assuming he's healthy in spring training. But you can make that caveat for every single starting pitcher. Obviously, it's dependent on them being healthy. So I absolutely have no problem taking Rodon as the third starting pitcher off the list. And I agree with you. So what else do I like about him? I love his context. So people say he's going to Yankee Stadium, he's going to the AL East. People have it in their mind because of the, you know, the joke that Yankee Stadium is to one side in terms of home runs, that it's a little league park. Statistically, that's not what Yankee Stadium is at all. So I think the AL East doesn't worry me. The home park doesn't worry me. As I talked about at First Pitch Arizona, I care about wins these days, because when you have almost a third of the teams that are tanking and don't have starting pitchers that are going deep into games, I care deeply about pitcher wins. And the Yankees are a team, one of a handful of teams, that really let their starters go deep into games and have a decent bullpen. So the context for him is great. And he showed last year in terms of he has the ability to pitch into games. He had more innings pitched per start than Woodruff, than Urias, than Gausman. Part of that is a virtuous cycle. If you're a good pitcher, you're going to pitch deeper into games because you're giving up more, less base runners. Even if you're striking out a lot of guys, it's getting blown up. It's giving up runs that cause pitches and pitchers not to go deep into games. So I love the context for him. So yeah, I'm all in on Rodon, and we've probably just screwed that up. And we're like 3.5 minutes into the podcast. So I've already screwed him up for a whole bunch of people. Who probably liked him going into March. Not to think we're moving ADP here, but my guess is some people are going to take a second look at him as compared to some of those other top starting pitchers.
I don't care. I don't care if his price goes up. I'm sick of people still getting him at the end of the third round in these DCs that I'm in. So I'd be okay with the price going up on him. I think I saw, I wish I could give credit. I think I saw the Yankees also have the easiest projected schedule in the AL East.
They don't have to play themselves.
Right. Exactly. And yeah, I agree with everything you said. Honestly, to me, Rodon versus Burns is kind of a coin flip. So I'm not going to end up with any Corbin Burns based on that, and unless they're both just going at the same place in March. All right. We're on the same page with Carlos Rodon. You mentioned Jacob deGrom. I was basically just going to ask you, I think he's either going to go top 10 in the March drafts that we do in Vegas, or he's going to go outside the top two rounds, kind of depending on his most recent spring performance. That's maybe the end of the analysis, but did you have anything you wanted to add with DeGrom?
We are all junkies, James, and Jacob deGrom is the little baggie being waved in front of us. There is no scenario. It's like early Noah Syndergaard. There's no scenario he shows up at Rangers spring training and doesn't look awesome. Unless he has an injury before his first bullpen, it's Jacob deGrom. That's what he does, is he looks awesome. And his fastball in that first spring training game with Statcast and a radar gun is going to be awesome. There's no scenario it's not awesome. So I think as a community, we can't resist him. But that's as we both why did a dummy use $100 of fab in the Platinum League last year to get a draft spot so he could take Jacob deGrom fifth overall? The dummy, just to be clear, is me, because I couldn't resist. He looks so good, and you run the numbers with a healthy Jacob deGrom. He's not just the best pitcher; he's the best player in fantasy. If Jacob deGrom makes 32 starts, he is the number one player in fantasy. And people miss that. They say, everybody says, and I know it's people who have been listening to 100 podcasts since November roll their eyes at this. He's the best pitcher per inning, but he can't stay healthy. He's not the best pitcher. He's the best player in fantasy if he stays healthy. But what are the statistical odds he makes 32 starts? I have no idea what it is. It's low. So then you start running projections based on 120 innings, 100 innings, 80 innings. And he's still worth something, but he's there's a lot of risk there compared to what the alternative is. So give me Carlos Rodon over Jacob deGrom pretty easily, regardless of what he did in spring. That being said, I'm a human. You give me that baggie, I may not be able to resist come time we're in Vegas in March. I'm just being honest with myself.
Well, and the reason, especially in the main event, something with an overall prize, a lot of people that have money to kind of throw around on these contests, it's just to try to win the main event overall, right? A lot of people won their share of main event leagues. And so they look at DeGrom as sort of this, uh, this piece that could lead to them being the overall champion.
And I heard Phil Dussault and Jeff Zimmerman talking about this in hour. I think it was hour six or hour seven of their appearance on Rob DiPietro's. Nobody really did, but I claimed that I did. I got an intern to write me a summary. And the point is, if you go back and look at actual main event winners, they don't take big risks in the first 10 rounds. It's the number one myth. And I agree. I think it was Jeff who said this and Phil agreed. It's the number one myth of how to win an overall is that you have that it's like a GPP in DFS. So you have to take these crazy risks. So you have crazy variance. So you want Byron Buxton, you want Jacob DeGrom, because boy, if it hits, that's how I'm going to win. And first off, like taking one or two of those risks, fine, fair enough. If you take multiple risks, because I need to load up on that, the probability of all of them hitting is very low. And then you've cut off your leg to save your arm. You haven't really moved the ball forward. But really, you want to be hitting solid doubles, maybe the odd triple with those early picks. So, I'm not sure that's the right approach, even in a contest with an overall. That being said, somebody's taking Jacob DeGrom early in every single draft. So, it's not a bad pick. It's just, again, I am the guy who used Real Fab to get him last year. So, what the hell do I know?
I apologize to everyone for even putting the DeGrom thing in the outline. I mean, I feel like everyone's probably just nodding along like, yeah, duh, like only a sucker takes DeGrom high. But I just know he's going to go super high.
And we won't be able to resist.
I'm with you. I haven't taken DeGrom since 2019, but he's going to go first round in my main event drafts, and that'll be that. What do you think people are like? I've talked a lot about the starting pitcher pool, especially sort of the top of the top 25 or so guys, and sort of the theme all offseason basically has been, whoever your favorite pitcher who goes outside the top 30 is, you're getting them at a perceived value in drafts currently, and so that is sort of the argument for basically Carlos Rodon and Corbin Burns is the argument for not taking Burns, right? Like, because you can get Carlos Rodon 20 picks later in a lot of drafts.
Well, I think everybody is, I shouldn't say everybody, because maybe other people who agree with me entirely. I think there's a big misnomer that's been made. Pitching is super deep. You don't need to reach for the top guys. Top guys are not as dominant as they are in typical years. So you certainly should be hitting early, and then starting pitching, because it just extends deeper and deeper into the draft, so you can afford to wait on starting pitchers. First off, so when I look at my projections right now and look at the SGPs, and for people who have no idea what SGP means, it's just a math way to look at how much every player is projected, or when you look at real statistics, does in fact move you up or down in the standings. So it's just a way to take statistics and translate it into a number, whether it's dollars or SGPs, to compare players. So when I look at the SGPs for the number one starting pitcher that I have in my projections, so Gerrit Cole, the gap between him and the 10th starting pitcher, so Kevin Gausman for me, but it doesn't really matter who the guy is the same as the gap between the 10th starting pitcher and the 32nd starting pitcher, which is another way of saying the top guy is just as dominant as is typical. That's not very different from previous years. There's this perception that you can just find starting pitching. It's just not true. Last year, 24 starting pitchers had a 25% or better strikeout rate in 130 more innings. There's one thing in common, James, with all 24 of those starting pitchers. It's not their like swinging strike weight rate. It's not like the spin rate on their fastball. The only thing that I could find that all 24 of those starting pitchers had in common, they were all projected by Steamer, and it's not just Steamer, it's the projections that I had handy, for a 24% or better strikeout rate. Meaning if you weren't projected for a 24% or better strikeout rate, there was no chance you were getting a 25% or better strikeout rate last year. Not a single sleeper got to 25%. There's nobody who came out of nowhere last year to strike out 25% of the guys. Go the next tier down. 24 starting pitchers last year had between a 22 and a 24% strikeout rate. Of those 24 starting pitchers, 23 of the 24 were projected for over a 20% strikeout rate. So as a group, they were projected for a 23.5% strikeout rate. They got a 22.5% strikeout rate. You know, the one sleeper was who snuck out into the top 48 starting pitchers in strikeout rate was Merrill Kelly. Now, we all know Merrill Kelly had a good spring training, blah, 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 blah. That's the sleeper starting pitcher last year to get into basically the top 50 starting pitchers in strikeout rate. So if you think it's easy to just find guys out of anywhere, it's like it's not easy. But the third point I'd make is we all go into drafts with a list, especially come March, of 10, 15, 20 starting pitchers we want to get late after the 15th round in the 200s, maybe in the 300s. Here's the problem. We're all too darn smart. And we all go into drafts with the exact same 15 to 20 of the list. My list, your list, guy next to you in the drafts list, and the woman sitting next to him had basically the same guys that we're going to fill out our pitching staff by. It's a long way of saying, like, I think you need to pay for pitching. This notion that you can piece it together for free because it's so deep and it's everywhere, I don't think that's true. And I hope a lot of people stick with that because I don't think it's going to work out well for them. I think you can maybe wait a round extra to get your SP1 this year than in previous years. First off, wait until March because starting pitchers in the NFBC always have helium going into March because closers start coming down because you can fab saves. And number two, so what? So you've waited an extra round for your SP1. I don't think that really shifts things as much as people seem to be talking about them shifting things. Anyways, it's been a long time since I did a podcast, James. I had this rant through the winter inside of me, and I appreciate you letting me get this long rant out. I don't know if you agree with it, but there it is.
Well, yeah, I don't really disagree with any of your points. What I sort of am referencing in terms of the depth is kind of what you touched on at the end there, where I think you can get a better, and I even believe this in March, I think you'll be able to get better starting pitchers in the third round than you could last year, and better starting pitchers in the fourth round than you could last year, and better starting pitchers in the fifth round than you could last year on the whole. And that would be sort of, to me, that might lead to me not taking a starting pitcher until the fourth round, which I rarely have done in high money leagues in the past. Do you take any issue with that?
I think the gap, as I said at point one, I think the gap between the top starting pitchers and the 10th, 12th, 15th starting pitchers is a steeper gap than you think it is. Number two, just to finish my points, is if I took Gerrit Cole in the first, let's say at the 15, 16 turn, for argument, and by Maine, I probably wouldn't be getting him there. But let's say I still get Cole or Burns or Rodon, frankly, at the 15, 16. The assumption you have today is that I'm not taking my second starting pitcher before that already. So it's all relative to your league. So you can still put together a fine staff. There's no doubt. You never have needed. Toby didn't decide the rule for everybody. You could always have had a fine winning pitching staff with your first starting pitcher coming in the fifth or sixth round. Because then the question is, who's your fifth starting pitcher? If your fifth starting pitcher is way better than everybody else's fifth starting pitcher, so you took five starting pitchers between round six and round 12, and four of those five hit and stay healthy, of course you can have a great pitching staff that way. It's, I think what's still hard, and I'll let you respond, because maybe I'm doing a straw man of what you're actually saying. I think the idea that you just don't need to use the same draft capital through the entirety of the draft on pitching as you've always had to is wrong. I think you can allocate it. Maybe this is your point a little bit differently between rounds to how you did. But I think that's always been true to a certain extent. It's where are you comfortable and how are you going to piece things together? Because there's obviously trade-offs, whatever you do.
Yeah. No, I think that's all right. And I totally... Like whoever, like, is like Gerrit Cole is also my SP1, and whoever my SP10 is, there is a big gap. But I think more people are able to get their personal SP5 higher than in past years.
That's fair. Fair. The other thing I should say, James, is you've done a lot of drafts. I've done zero drafts. So you are more informed on this than I am, because I'm just looking at how things are unfolding.
But you are right about, I think I love like where Zach Gallen's going, and I love where Luis Castillo are going, but those guys aren't going to be going there, obviously.
Not even close.
So,
not even
close. But in my online championship draft I'm doing tonight, they will be going yes. later than I think they should. So,
yeah, sure.
Okay. We're going to head to a message from our sponsors, and then we're going to come back, and Rob and I are going to compare where some players are going in drafts versus where some projection systems say they should be going, and see whether we side with the projections or the public.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The fantasy baseball season is underway, and there's no better place to play than Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy baseball. Right now, Underdog has MLB best ball tournaments live, including the Dinger, which has a 500K total prizes. In best ball, all you do is join a contest, draft your team, and that's it. There are no waivers, no trades, and no in-season management. Draft 20 rounds of players and get the best cumulative scores in your starting lineup. Three pitchers, three infielders, three outfielders, and one flex each week of the regular season. Getting started is simple. Go to underdogfantasy.com, sign up with the promo code RWMLB, and not only will Underdog double your initial deposit up to $100, but you'll also get 6 months of our RotoWire subscription for free. Again, that's Underdog Fantasy, promo code RWMLB. Draft your 100K Dinger team today. Fantrax is the most customizable fantasy platform in the industry, offering the greatest fantasy experience for your dynasty, keeper, redraft, and best ball leagues. Fantrax can import your current leagues and customize if needed. Fantrax has the most in-depth player pool, especially relevant in dynasty leagues. You don't have to have the commissioner put in like a placeholder prospect that you want to add. All the prospects are in there. We use Fantrax for the Highlander Dynasty Invitational, which is great because that's an open universe league. All those guys are already in the player pool. They have advanced stats that you can use to sort free agents with. You can filter out prospects or just filter out big leaguers in your search for the best fab experience out there. I strongly recommend Fantrax for any Dynasty and Keeper leagues. It's the best site out there for those formats. Sign up for free today and be entered to win an official MLB jersey signed by Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Simply go to fantrax.com/rotowire and sign up today. That's FANTRAX.com/rotowire. Fantrax, the home of fantasy sports. All right, we're back. So, Rob, you and I—I think we talked briefly about Adley Rutschman when we were out in First Pitch Arizona, and he's very interesting to me. Since all the projection systems have come out, you know, I usually expect projection systems to be lower on players like Rutschman, who are, you know, young and less proven. But I was a little surprised at just sort of how much lower they are than I am on him, or at least I was on him before all the projections came out. He just, everything I'm kind of looking for in a player who's about to take a massive step forward, like I see all of it with Rutschman. He led all catcher eligible players with 250 plate appearances from August 1st on, and would have actually ranked sixth, tied with Jeff McNeil and Mookie Betts among outfield eligible players in plate appearances from August 1st on. But you know, he scored 70 runs last year, and there are projection systems that don't even think he'll get to 70 runs this year in a full season. You know, none of the Fangraphs projection systems have him getting to 20 homers. Every Fangraphs projection system other than Zips has him hitting under 260. So I say all that to ask you if you are closer to the market on Adley Rutschman, who's currently going fourth among catchers, or are you closer to the projections? And every projection system would tell you just wait a couple rounds and take Wilson Contreras, Alejandro Kirk, or Sean Murphy, rather than taking Adley where you need to take him in drafts.
So if you take the projection systems and give Rutschman Buster Posey's peak playing time. So Buster Posey, it's a good analogy, right? Like a really good catcher, key to the team, important to the pitching staff. Like I think it's even if they're slightly different players, I don't think it, I didn't want to take Sal Perez because he's such an outlier in terms of like driving him into the ground. Obviously, Buster Posey didn't have the DH, so maybe it's even a little bit conservative, but go with me. So if I take the projections, aggregate them, give him Buster Posey's peak season of 623 plate appearances, he comes out as catcher four. So like you've done that, and he's exactly where the market is. Now, that's a really stupid way to draft, assuming that he's exactly the same as the busiest season of a Hall of Fame catcher in his second year. So then the question I ask is, so which of the categories is he most likely to overachieve the projections on? Put aside stolen bases, because I don't think it's stolen bases, even with the rule change. I think that's safe. I think I kind of agree with you. I think the easiest one for him to do is runs and RBIs. Like they have him averaging basically a run at plus RBI per game, which is what he had last year. But I think it's not unreasonable to add, call it 10 runs, 10 RBIs kind of thing. And that will push him up pretty quickly in terms of rankings. I think the reason to like him is not so much that he has this massive breakout season. It's the immense floor that he gives you at catcher. Like it's hard to pick a player other than Real Muto, maybe in the catcher position, who from a reliability, health, and just they are going to keep him on the field almost every game one way or another than Rutschman. And I think that the market, whether I'll ultimately pay the price or not, we'll see. But I think the market is not wrong to say there's a chance of him exceeding the projections. But really, I like that floor at catcher. If I'm paying for a premium catcher position and I'm not getting one of the speed catchers, then I just love what a Will Smith or what a Rutschman do for me in terms of just plug it, forget it, and I can kind of count that that's coming. So I think that's the argument for him.
Great, yeah, that's my argument for him as well, and I like that you kind of agree with me to some extent there. I do think he would probably be my pick. to lead all catchers in runs scored, which, you know, I that would be quite the feat for a guy in his first, his true first kind of full big league season. And I do think the, you know, I don't think he's going to steal double digit bases, but I sort of have a, I think there's going to be more than just the Varsho Realmuto catchers stealing significant bases this year. I could see a case for Melendez getting close to double digit steals, and I could also see Rutschman getting six or seven steals, which is not nothing.
No doubt. Six steals from your catcher is a big deal. That's a five, six stolen base gap between everybody else's catcher one. So that's, that helps a ton on his value.
This is a sort of related to this, but just quickly, like how do you feel as like a Blue Jays fan? Now that sort of all the dust has kind of settled on that catcher trio, and now you've got Dalton Varsho as sort of a key piece going forward. How do you think that all shook out for your Blue Jays?
I'm thrilled. Like I'm huge on Varsho for this year. I think he's going to be awesome for the Jays in real baseball and fantasy. I'm thrilled. I think the Danny Jansen Alejandro Kirk combo may be frustrating at times for fantasy owners, because the thing that will kill people is if both of them are good, you're going to want both of them to play every day, and you're not going to get them playing every day. I think the Jays are quite happy to have both of them playing like 60% of the time, both of them basically catching half the time, and Kirk DHing, you know, a quarter of the games, Jansen the odd DH game, if he's hitting as well as I think he may be hitting. And people will be screaming like, why aren't both of them playing every single day? And they just won't. So it may be a bit frustrating fantasy wise, but as a Jays fan, I was getting worried, but I think they cashed in the Marino chip the best they possibly could, the way that just the baseball industry values guys these days.
Have you talked to Vlad Sedler at all about his guy, Brandon Belt?
There have been words exchanged on the text on the subject. Look, I think Belt will be a very useful piece of the Jays as long as he's healthy. I think if I'm in a DC draft, having Belt on my bench as cheap as he's going, so I can put him in when they have the right weekly schedule and he's healthy, is great. I think that he's pretty much undraftable in fab leagues, because I just don't think he's going to play enough. There may be weeks where you're streaming him in or not out. So I could easily see a Brandon Belt being picked up. I'd set the over under in, let's say, the main event on times Brandon Belt will dropped and picked up in the average league at like 10.5 times picked up. And that's amazing. And that's useful. And that's like not nothing. But that's different from going into a draft saying, I'm drafting Brandon Belt and I'm writing in pen the 28 home runs I'm getting for him. I don't think Brandon Belt wants to play that much. Like, that's just not what's being set up here. But from a real baseball perspective, I love having Brandon Belt for when he's healthy. I think he's a great, useful tool and player for that lineup as long as he's healthy.
Okay, so we talked some Jays. Now let's talk about, let's stay in that division. Do you think we should care much at all about Masataka Yoshida's projections and or the fact that the Red Sox gave him that much money? Because I don't really think we should care, but I'm interested in your
opinion. So he is one of the weirdest players and toughest players for me to get my head around. If you take his, like, again, his average of his projections, but it really doesn't matter which. It's not like Derek Carty's low on him. It's not like there's nobody who's low on him. He was a top 25 hitter if he does that this year. If he did that last year, he would have been a top 25 real baseball hitter. And yet all we heard when they signed him, the Red Sox, for 5 years, $90 million, was that they overpaid. I pulled the quote from Kylie McDaniel, who obviously has great sources with Major mm-hmm. League Baseball teams. And he said all 10 sources he talked to thought the Red Sox overpaid by a hefty margin. One executive went so far as to say, we thought he was worth less than half what they paid. So there's obviously a massive disconnect here between what the Red Sox thought they bought, what the projections, all of them, think they bought, and what apparently every other team in baseball thought they bought. So what are the scenarios? One, the Red Sox and the projections are right and everyone else is wrong. That's possible. The Red Sox and the projections are right and everyone else is bitter. And like we're spinning Kylie McDaniel because they wanted to get him for 5 years, $75 million. Or the Red Sox and the projections are wrong. The one thing that makes no sense to me about the public projections, though, and this is the dilemma, is on the one hand, they think he's like literally a top 25 hitter in baseball. And on the other hand, they're super conservative on playing time. If you buy the projections and he's hitting leadoff because like, A, I think they have said he is our leadoff hitter. And number two, if he's as good as the projections think he is, he's definitely, if not leading off, hitting second or third endeavors, like whatever, he's top. And as long as he's healthy and he hits his projections, he's a 650 plate appearances guy. So what's weird is, as incredible as the projections are, they're understated because if you buy the rates, you have to boost the projections. And if you start giving him 650 plate appearances, he's the best buy in fantasy. Now, I don't believe that's true, but you can't both say he's awesome and he's getting 500 plate appearances unless you think he gets hurt. So it's weird to me. I don't know what the hell. What are you doing with him, James?
Well, I mean, that's why I brought him up, is because it's, if he just does what the projections say, like you said, he's just an amazing value right now. And everyone who drafts him can turn around and say, what were you guys all doing? Like, it was right there in the projections. So I just, to me, kind of thinking about it, thinking about the caliber or the type of, not even the caliber, but the type of pitching that he's used to versus the type of pitching he'll be facing, I just think there's going to be some sort of adjustment period, even if it's just, you know, maybe he only hits 10 homers this year. And then as he gets more accustomed to big league pitching, he's more of a 15 to 20 homer guy. But I don't know, man. If it had been, and it's almost sort of the opposite of an appeal to authority, because if it had been a team that I thought was smart that gave him that exact contract, I would be like, yeah, the projections are probably right on this guy.
Yeah. If he's on the Dodgers right now, then we're all saying like, oh my gosh, the Dodgers have done it again. That was their big offseason acquisition. And somehow they have another, you know, Freddie Freeman, Mookie Betts, and look, they have a third like superstar on their team.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd say is his cost, if it stays where it is right now, is cheap enough. Mm-hmm. The projections can be quite wrong. And he's still a pretty good just volume play who's kind of filling up the stat. He doesn't need to hit his projections to be worth his current cost.
Yeah, and his current cost, just to reference it now, is 52nd outfielder off the board in the 27 NFBC Draft Champions since the Bat X was released on January 12th. And he's going behind Whit Merrifield. He's going behind Joey Meneses. He's going behind multiple Oakland A's hitters.
You don't want to take anybody after the Oakland A's hitters, James. So one, that's like the new Mendoza line in fantasy. If an Oakland player has been picked, you've missed the boat at this point.
Once the Oakland hitters start getting picked,
it's too late. Yep.
That's exactly. It should be called the Oakland line.
Yeah, exactly.
In ADP. All right. So I was really surprised to see this. I knew where Lucas Giolito was getting drafted, but the range is crazy. He's gone between pick 135 and 160, so 25 pick range in 27 draft champions, which is a very narrow range for a player who I view as very volatile. And the market's actually significantly higher on Giolito than every projection system. So, A, what do you make of Giolito heading into this season? And I know you sort of addressed this on Twitter, but I'm going to make you say it on the pod anyway. And then B, if you draft him in the 9th or 10th round, are you starting him week one against the Astros?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what I tweeted was Lucas Giolito. There are some pitchers who are very linear in terms of the correlation between their velocity and their success. And ERA is a lazy, misleading stats, and you shouldn't use ERA for forward looking, but it does. It's descriptive in terms of what actually happened since 2019, start of the 2019 season. In games where Lucas Giolito's fastball has averaged less than 93 miles an hour, and he's had lots of games, most of last season, where his fastball averaged less than 93 miles an hour, he had a 4.78 ERA. When his fastball was in the 93s, so between 93 and 94, 3.9 ERA. So pretty good, but league average-ish. When his fastball was 94 or better, 3.52 ERA, very good. That's what you think of when you think of good Lucas Giolito. And 95 or better, a 2.4 ERA. Jeff Zimmerman tweeted out the swing strike rates for his slider, and it was almost exactly the same. You know, slow slider, medium slider, fast slider, crappy swinging strike rate, pretty good swinging strike rate, great swinging strike rate. And the problem is, so the answer for most players would be, okay, so we'll see in spring training. We'll get numbers because there's enough Arizona parks that have Statcast. We'll have good numbers on Giolito, and therefore you'll have a sense. Are you getting good Lucas Giolito or are you getting bad Lucas Giolito? And we'll all adjust. The problem, of course, was the reason why so many of us got sucked in last spring training by Lucas Giolito. Casey Cha took him in second round of every single draft he was in, basically, poor Casey, was he was hitting 97. He came to spring training last year as just this horse Lucas Giolito, and he was killing it, and then it was gone. And you can say, well, but he got injured. There was an oblique injury or something, and like so that's where the velocity went, and that's why he was so, like, he was basically unrosterable for most of last season, but it was the worst case scenario, right? It's Lucas Giolito. I can't just drop him. And his strikeout rate numbers are bad, but they're not that bad. So I have to keep holding him. I have to keep holding him. I have to keep holding him. And it never really got any better. There were glimpses at times of it getting better, but it, for the most part, was pretty crappy. So the problem is I will be skeptical even if he shows up in spring training and is, you know, sitting 95. He was hitting 97. He wasn't sitting 97. But even if he's sitting 95 in spring training, I just don't know that he can hold it for 6 months. But I don't think it's a bad bet where he's going that he will be able to hold it. So it is a true risk when you buy Lucas Giolito. And I think unlike, you know, a first or second round risk, in the 9th, 10th round, you could be getting a borderline SP1 there if he it can both get back to where he needs to be velocity-wise and hold it for at least most of 6 months. The problem is there are a whole bunch of starting pitchers going just before and just after Lucas Giolito who are at least 90%, to my mind, of Lucas Giolito. Maybe not quite the ceiling of Lucas Giolito, but pretty darn close to Lucas Giolito. Like, what's the difference between Charlie Morton and Lucas Giolito if you assume both of them stay healthy for 6 months? They're pretty close. Like, will I acknowledge Lucas Giolito's ceiling is higher than Charlie Morton at this point, career's ceiling? Yeah, probably. But their 50th percentile is, like, actually, their 50th percentile, Charlie Morton, is better. But you know what I'm saying? Like, and I'm getting a bit of a discount, and I kind of have more faith in Charlie Morton than I do Lucas Giolito. I just picked him out at random. Like, Pablo Lopez, injury risk too, but so is Lucas Giolito. Like, he's going after Lucas Giolito. I love Drew Rasmussen, Jeffrey Springs. Like, these are a lot of starting pitchers going right after him who are pretty good. And so I'm not sure I'll take the risk on Lucas Giolito being good because I know what bad Lucas Giolito is. Last year, he was unusable.
Yeah. And I had Giolito in a couple leagues last year. And I mean, the key was to just sort of cut your losses sooner than later. And he didn't kill you if you did that. Because you can still kind of make that up, but he also probably prevented you from getting super high level outcomes, especially in anything with an overall. I just was sort of thinking about it as, like, I draft Lucas Giolito, what he does in those first three or four starts, it's going to start playing head games. Unless it just goes great, it's going to start playing head games with you, because he has the Astros the first lineup period, then he has Pittsburgh, and so you might think, well, I'll sit him against the Astros, and then I'll plug him in against the Pirates, and then it'll be off to the races from there. But then what if like the Pirates get to him in that second start? Are you just benching him no matter who he's facing in that third start? And so I just think it's going to be a volatile type of pick where you should at least sort of think about how you would react as the person that drafts him if he gets off to a slow start, and whether you want to even deal with that.
I don't think it's an unreasonable rule, James, to say if I will not use a starting pitcher in the first week because of his matchup, I shouldn't take him in the first 10 rounds, maybe with an asterisk unless he's going to Colorado. Sure. But even then, I think it's a pretty good like litmus test. How much faith do you have in him? If your answer is I cannot start him against Houston and like sleep that week, so I have to bench him against Houston, then I think your answer should be, if I'm giving you free advice, which is unless you're one of your advertisers, what you've paid for this podcast, then I think that the answer is take one of the other starting pitchers or somebody else around him. If you think, yeah, no, I have enough faith in him that I'll start him against Houston and see how it goes, then the value could be there, and it could be tremendous. Like, look, if he goes seven innings, strikes out 10, and gives up one run against Houston, you're waking up for week two saying, I probably just drafted an SP1, SP2 in the 10th round. That's how overall main events are won. It's not taking Jacob deGrom in the first round. It's getting Lucas Giolito in the 10th round, and he returns first round value. Like, that's how you win the main overall.
Yeah, that's a...
Now, personally, I would not start him against Houston, so I'm probably not taking him. So that's just me.
Would you start Lance Lynn against Houston?
If I drafted Lance Lynn, I would.
Yeah. I mean, Lance Lynn's going a little bit of like half a round ahead of Giolito. Yeah. And I would take Lance Lynn over Giolito.
Lance Lynn finished the year really strong too. Like, Lance Lynn had a great second half. He was back to being a pretty, pretty good, solid pitcher.
Okay. So, I wanted to ask you about Yandy Diaz.
Yandy Diaz.
And part of the reason why I wanted to ask you about it, I was just sort of thinking the other day, kind of what is there a 7% chance Yandy Diaz shows up this year with an idea of how to get the ball in the air? And then if he does that, then what's his ceiling? But kind of, there's such a gap between the projection systems and the ADP that it's almost more, he doesn't even need to make an adjustment to be a good pick where he's going. 25th third baseman off the board in recent DCs, projected as a top 13 third baseman by BatX, ATC, and Steamer. So I guess just simply, are the projections too high, or is the public too low, or is it just a more kind of boring answer if it's somewhere in the middle?
All of the above. I mean, let's look at Yandy Diaz. Like, he doesn't run. I don't think that's going to change. No. He has never, ever hit home runs. Like, this isn't a two-year, like, I keep banging the ball into the ground. He has, over the last 12 years, 4,820 plate appearances. That's from, like, Cuban League baseball to the majors. In 4,820 plate appearances, that, which is a lot, they're like, that's a decent sample size, including like Cuba, 72 home runs. That works out to 9 home runs per 600 plate appearances, with a career high of the 14 he hit 2 years ago in Tampa. But James, me using 600 plate appearances for Yandy Diaz, that's absurd. He's never hit 600 plate appearances. The highest he's ever got is 558 last year, mm-hmm. which sure feels like his ceiling in Tampa, just the way they use things. And to be clear, Yandy Diaz is a really good real baseball player. So it's like, they're not going to, I think that if he's healthy, like 558, the band around that is pretty narrow, but he's not somebody who's getting the rare Tampa exception of getting to 650. Like, so 550 is his mm-hmm. maximum. So the argument for him being way better is two things, like Statcast. Yes, mm-hmm. Statcast. He's awesome. If for your Statcast league, he's awesome. Like if you're playing in a league where barrels are a category, he's awesome. And two, that he changes. That finally, in his 13th year, he becomes somebody he isn't. And there are small signs. And I know the Yandy stands, or how, whatever we call the Yandy bros, like the people who are true believers in Yandy Diaz, and they're out there. Believe like he's on the verge of a breakout. I'm not sure I see that. But as you suggested, like for his cost, you really don't need him to do anything approaching a breakout. Like he just needs to keep doing what he's doing. And he's a tremendous buy for people who approach drafts as, like, think about it as an auction. I spent $3 on him. He returned $7. I just made a $4 profit. He's not going to earn me $22, but I'm very happy to take $4. By definition, if you make, take a $4 profit on every single roster spot, you've just won your league. You've won the overall. Like you've done amazing things. So you just need to get a bunch of Yandy Diazes who outperform their draft spot, and you can do really well. I get why the market doesn't see that, though. It's hard sometimes, especially in the NFBC, to say this guy gives me no stolen bases, gives me really no home runs. So he's giving me kind of an empty-ish batting average with like some counting stats, runs and RBIs, but I can kind of stream, I can surely stream Yandy Diaz together. And maybe you can, but like you also have to draft guys. And it also feels like, sorry, and I'll end, that Yandy Diaz isn't that interesting. I don't need to go on for 20 minutes on Yandy Diaz. It also feels like Yandy Diaz has been on the free agent wire every single year, every single week, which I know isn't true, but it just feels like, why would I draft Yandy Diaz? I can pick him up in week 3. And the reality is he's much better than that. So I think it's somewhere in the middle. But if he's going off as like the 25th third baseman, you said, taking him 23rd, that's pretty good. Like don't take him 13th, but like much closer to his ADP. It's obviously where anybody would take him. It's a pretty good buy. Pretty good buy.
Yeah, and to, you know, a couple of your points, he was the Rays' best position player by a full win above replacement last year. Better than Arozarena. Obviously, Wander was hurt, and he, the things that he is going to grade out really well in batting average and runs, you know, those aren't the stats that tend to get guys pushed up ADP alone. Like it is the power, the lack of power, lack of speed, and the lack of, you know, that monster upside. But yeah, I like it. I kind of like, I like third base in the kind of the back half of drafts, the more drafts I do. But if you, I mean, I just like, I like Yandy. I like Moncada. There's probably a few others, but also you can't just assume you'll get one of your preferred options if you wait. But yeah, third base, not a waste of time.
Do not reach for any position because you're worried you're not, I have to get one of the top X position Y. No, you don't. You can have the worst of that position as long as your team puts up enough stats. You do not need any. There's no line that you have to be above. It's one of the great myths of fantasy baseball.
Yeah, in a 15-team league, especially your one of your starting position players isn't going to be very good, at least. Here's a fun question. I was going to tailor this question around a specific player, but I thought it'd be more fun to see if we came up with the same player or a similar player. So the question is, who will be this year's Byron Buxton? And by that, I mean goes much higher, like kind of inexplicably goes much higher in those late March drafts, sort of out of nowhere, than he was going the whole drafting season leading up to then. Because, I mean, obviously you were there. There was just sort of a Byron Buxton buzz going through the conference room on that Saturday in Vegas for the main event of just sort of, where'd he go in this draft? Where'd he go in that draft? Because all of a sudden people showed up to Vegas and decided Buxton was going to be their ticket to the main event title. But who is a player that could be this year's Buxton, where all of a sudden we show up to those Vegas drafts and he's just going way higher than he was before then?
Easy call for me. So it'll be freaky if we landed on the same guy. Corbin Carroll. I think Corbin Carroll is going to go, if he shows up and is as sexy at spring training and is going to play every single day, they're not platooning him. They're obviously not sending him down to manage his service time. I could see, I don't think there's any ceiling on how high Corbin Carroll, I don't think he's literally going to go in the first round this year, but I think Corbin Carroll will be nowhere near where he is. And he's obviously already going pretty early, but I think he's going to be much, much earlier. I think people will have dreams of Julio in their mind and they will pay up. And then the next day, when people see what the new min price is, they will go even higher. And then the next day, they will go even higher. And he could easily be a solid second round pick by Vegas, which sounds crazy. But here we are.
Yeah, that's a really good call. You're probably right. I think it's probably more likely to be your guy than my guy. And I feel very comfortable taking Carroll high, and it's sort of been an ADP game for me in these drafts. So I'll be fascinated to see where Carroll goes and how he does in spring training leading up to then. Will definitely play a role. My guy also sort of hinges on what he does in the spring, and he happens to be going one pick behind Carroll in ADP of those recent draft champions I've been citing, and that's O'Neill Cruz.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know how this goes. You know how the highlights of O'Neill Cruz in spring training are going to go. And he's...
27 plate appearances in. He's only struck out two times. He's fixed things.
Right. He'll have a strikeout rate in the low 20s or whatever, and by far the biggest exit velocity of anyone in Grapefruit League play. And maybe he's running wild on the bases, and that could be interesting.
The similarity between the two of them is, and they're both obviously crazy talented and both potential first round players. So I'm not, it sounds like I'm poo-pooing either of them. I know we have a PG podcaster, so I'll use poo-poo. I'm allowed to say poo-poo on the RotoWire.
Oh, you can say whatever you want.
But both of those picks, if they have helium, and I think O'Neill Cruz is a great call. But Corbin Carroll or O'Neill Cruz, it's FOMO. It's like, I can't miss out on these guys. I have to get them. And it doesn't matter what I have to do. I have to get them on my team. Like, I don't want to look stupid by missing out on this. And in life, in business, and in fantasy baseball, decisions being driven by FOMO almost always are wrong. Like, you make so many poor decisions when that is what's driving your decision-making. Which again is not a knock on either player. Both players are tremendous players with potential flaws, just to be clear. Corbin Carroll's power may not be quite there yet. Everybody says, of course, he's going to hit 20. May not. And O'Neill Cruz, everybody knows what the downside is. But I absolutely can see the FOMO in March driving people towards crazy things they don't think they're going to want to do right now. Luckily, we're too smart to fall for that change, right? Yeah.
Not us.
Not us. Those other dummies who are coming to the NFBC main, they may do it, but not us.
Let's see who these suckers are going to reach for.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll collect our cash.
All of the money.
Okay, so this final question before we get to 20th round ADP, I was going to ask you if Oswald Peraza might be this year's Jeremy Peña, but you thought of another shortstop prospect who I've always sort of thought was sort of a light version of Oswald Peraza. And so I think it's just kind of perfect that we were both sort of thinking of this year's Jeremy Peña and came up with two very similar shortstop prospects. And your guy's Michael Garcia, much less fame and fanfare, especially lately. I know Peraza sort of seems to be kind of a hot name out there. But I think it's still, Peraza is going higher than Pena was last year, but not, he's still not going that high. And Garcia probably fits the Pena comp a bit better, just in the sense that he's going really late right now. Mm-hmm. So why don't you sort of start with Garcia and sort of what you find
appealing? No, look, people come to this podcast, James, to get my take on prospects. That's why most people are tuning in right now. And for those who don't know, I was very high on Pena, higher than James last year. James, who knows prospects and studies prospects, me, who does not. And Pena last year was this year's Jonathan India. As of today, Michael Garcia, for those who don't know who he is, he's a middle infielder on Kansas City. He doesn't have a job as of today. So that is the big difference between him and Jeremy Pena. Was at this point last year already, Pena was really the only option Houston had on their roster to play shortstop. That's not the case with Peraza. Obviously, my understanding is there's a decent prospect on the Yankees who also could play shortstop this year. And it's certainly not the case with Garcia. So the similarities, he has a very good glove. So he's a good fielding infielder. That's one of the things I liked about Jeremy Pena, was his glove could carry him even if the bat took a little bit of time. Probably has more speed than Pena has, probably has a little bit less power. So one of the questions about Garcia was, does he hit for enough power? His power is starting to develop in the minors. He just had a really good Winter League campaign in Venezuela this year. I don't know if he was the MVP, but he had a really good Winter League where he was hitting for a little bit of power. Last year, he went 11 home runs, 39 stolen bases across all levels. So he has serious speed. He is the better version of Adalberto Mondesi. Like, he is what people close their eyes and thought Mondesi was going to be. He's that without like the giant warts that Mondesi had. How does he get his playing time? Well, Hunter Dozier is their third baseman right now. I just don't believe that this team that's going nowhere is going to give 600 plate appearances to Hunter Dozier. So maybe Witt moves back to third base and Garcia plays shortstop. Massey is their second baseman. Maybe it's Garcia who's their second baseman. They have like two pylons in the outfield right now. So like there's a lot of different paths to Garcia coming out of spring training, and he's the kind of guy like Pena, and then I'll stop, who's like an electric guy that you can tell all the other players really like. So I think if he gets a bit of momentum and starts playing well in spring training, it's not crazy for me that he breaks camp with a starting job. If he does that, then I think like a 10-25 season, he has a good enough like hit tool that I think 250 is reasonable. But like 10-25, 250 from a free player is pretty good. Like that'll play for you in your fantasy league. So that's my pick. Because there's easy ones, right? Like Vaughn Grissom is easy. Ezekiel Tovar is easy. Even Bryce Terang. Like there's a lot of middle infielders who kind of fit this profile with various costs right now. So I haven't landed on my actual Jeremy Pena because I need to know who has jobs. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of candidates this year. Like a good year for that kind of profile of a bit of power, a bit of speed out of young middle infielders.
Yeah, so Garcia going in the 45th round of draft champions right now. On average, obviously wide swings there. But I agree with I might be – a little lower than you in terms of, you know, you're probably right. Like 10 homers or 10-15 is probably you can hope for that and accept that it might be a little lower than that, especially in that park. Mm-hmm. I think 25 steals is totally reasonable if the plate appearances are there. And I definitely agree with you. Hunter Dozier and Michael Massey shouldn't be blocking anyone, especially someone who is a good defensive shortstop who can hit a little. So I buy it. He's not going to go like he's not going to be as valuable as Jeremy Pena was this year, but he's a really good value where he's going, or he could be a really good value where he's going.
To be clear, Jeremy Pena was not going to be as valuable as Jonathan India last year either. So you never know what's going to happen with these kids, James.
Well, I would like to know, because I think, yeah, I mean, you're right. Jonathan India last year was sort of what I thought Jonathan India would be 2 years ago.
But by the way, if we want to talk about thing players' projections are getting wrong, I think Jeremy Peña projections are getting wrong. I think they're way too conservative on him. Just look at his numbers before the injury, after he came back too soon from the injury, and then September, October, and the playoffs, and it's a tale of three seasons. And you'd never want to go too far with that and try to break up the season to tell a story that happens to agree with your pre-existing biases. But I feel quite confident that next year we're going to look back on the projections for Jeremy Peña and say they were way too conservative on him.
Yeah, no, I agree with you about Peña. And on Peraza, I would pretty much echo a lot of the traits you were talking about with Garcia. I just think he's better at everything, just like a little bit better at everything. And, you know, they're going to be hit. They're both going to probably hit bottom third of their lineup, at least until they force the issue to move up. And I think Peraza is a lot closer to Volpe as a prospect than most people think. And so I'm not, you know, if Peraza is not performing well after April and May, then someone could come and take his job. Maybe kind of a lift. Maybe, you know, the Yankees just piss everyone off and give Aaron Hicks and kind of Falefa a bunch of playing time early. And Oswald Peraza ends up on waivers in some leagues. You know, that's probably the case for stopping this crazy ascent that he's seeing in ADP, because it'll get to a point where, you know, you might have to drop this guy first week of the season and you're taking him as like a clear starter for you. Yeah. But I'm buying Peraza. I'm buying the skills. I buy that he is, and he's a better defensive shortstop than Volpe. And so I think he's going to take that job and kind of put his stamp on it. And Volpe's going to have to find a way to fit in at third base or at second base, or they trade someone. But I think Peraza can take the job and run with it as long as the Yankees don't go into the spring with the intention of starting the year with Kiner Falefa in that role. Do you have any Peraza thoughts?
Yeah, I think if you could guarantee me he has that he plays 140 games, I think he's a pretty easy 15-20. And even with his price going up, my best case, like 15-20 from his price is tremendous. And worst case scenario, I have to waive him after 1 week and be streaming a middle infielder. I can live with that. If I was drafting now, which I don't do, I would make sure I have like a DC. I would make sure that I'm not counting on the plate appearances, that he's an upside play, or that I back him up pretty quickly. But if you guaranteed me that he's going to play 140, 145 games, I think like he is by definition a better candidate to be John India, Jeremy Peña than anybody else. Cause I think 15-20 is eminently reasonable for him.
Yeah, there are more speed flyers going in the second half of drafts this year that I actually like than last year.
There's no doubt. We may even talk about one or two of them in around 20. this is called foreshadowing in the business, James. But yeah, I absolutely agree. They're not just speed flyers. It's not like I'm taking Gerard Dyson or Billy Hamilton
or Miles Straw.
Miles Straw was an elite pick last
year. Yeah, he wasn't a flyer.
Forget. But like there is such a big difference between a 20 stolen base guy who has a realistic chance at 12 to 16, like 15 to 17 home runs. So is far from a zero in this home run environment. If you assume the 2022 environment is the same as this year, as a Gerard Dyson who has no path, or a John Birdie, frankly, who has no path to any real power. Like these are guys who could, and this is the thing with a lot of these guys, if you could guarantee the playing time, like these are easy top 100 players, because they're also not total batting average sinks. Like they may not be hitting 280, but they're not hitting 200 either. Well, that's the definition of five category guy, even if they're hitting seventh or eighth in the lineup. Not ideal, but you can live with a couple of guys late like that.
Yeah. Is since I brought Miles Straw up, and that was another one of your great calls from last year's pod, is, does Jake McCarthy fit under that OPS rule?
I don't think so. I think McCarthy is seen as he's a legit average hitter, and therefore I'm not going into drafts necessarily with a McCarthy strategy, which depending on your historical references can mean lots of different things. But no, he's nowhere close to the kind of fade that a Miles Straw was in terms of he's going to lose his job.
All right. Rob,
it's much more of an issue. Sorry, just to finish on McCarthy. Yeah. The bigger issue there is just it's a crowded. There's a lot of mouths to be fed there. So it's not that I think he's going to lose his job. I worry that he's not going to get 600 plate appearances and he's going to have part of the job just because there's a lot of guys there still.
All right. I do not have any Jake McCarthy yet. And I didn't take a ton of Miles Straw last year, but I did have a couple shares. So live to regret that one. But we move on to round 20th ADP. Every week we've been going through me and a guest from the 10th round on, or the 11th round on, actually. And we're now in round 20. Rob and I are each going to pick a player that we're buying in the 20th round and a player that we're fading at that cost. And so here are the 15 players going in the 20th round of NFBC Draft Champions Leagues. Austin Meadows, Garrett Whitlock, Jared Kelenic, Spencer Torkelson, Manuel Margot, Jorge Soler, Evan Phillips, Eric Haas, Jake Fraley, Trent Grisham, Matt Mervis, Craig Kimbrell, Luis Garcia of the Nationals, Chris Taylor, and Dylan Carlson. And people who listened to last week's episode will know that Matt Mervis was in the 19th round a week ago. So you can tell how quickly his ADP is plummeting. If you really want to make a strong case against Mervis here, go for it, but I assume we'll just pick more.
I will not. That was cheap. But I honestly, James, I like five or six of the hitters here. So why don't you go first for the like guy, and I'll go first for the fade guy, because I can go in multiple directions in terms of who I like here.
Sure. So I also like a couple of these hitters. I'll go with Manuel Margot as my buy here. Kind of what we were talking about a few minutes ago, you know, cheap five-ish category production. You're not getting a full five categories from Margot, but he's not going to hurt your average. I think he gets you double-digit steals pretty easily. I think he's is he the Rays' best outfielder? He was playing better than Arias Arena for before he got hurt last year, but we'll call him their second best outfielder. And so I believe in the playing time for Margot to the extent you can believe in a Rays player's playing time. So I think he's a nice roster build piece here with the playing time and the speed. But who's your buy?
Like I said, I have a bunch of guys I like here. So some I assume in real drafts will be taken in 17th, 18th, 19th round, because why wouldn't I? The guy I'll talk about though is Chris Taylor. Chris Taylor was a top 80 player in 2021, a top 100 player in 2020 in the short season for his career. He's averaged 17 home runs, 13 stolen bases, 256 average per 162 games. He obviously had a miserable season last year, but he is a great bounce back candidate on a Dodgers team where, especially with his position flexibility, he can obviously play center field if they need him to be a center fielder. He can play everywhere basically for the Dodgers. He is the perfect kind of complementary piece that gives you a bit of power, a bit of speed, a batting average that won't kill you. And I think if he's healthy, likely to play every day because they just don't have the depth that they've had previously. But I think he's also good. So I'm not just saying that kind of lazy, who else are they going to play? Say that about Jake Fraley. Who else are they going to play? I think with Chris Taylor, they actually want to play him on a still a very good Dodgers team. So my pick will be Chris Taylor. I think he's a real nice value as a complimentary piece on a fantasy team, whether a DC or a fab league at this kind of price.
Yeah, Chris Taylor eligible at outfield and second base. I think he went to driveline this winter to try to improve his bat speed and exit velocity. So,
do you adjust for guys who go to driveline? Do you buy into like a driveline bump?
If Eno hit me up last year to sort of tell me about Lars Nootbaar going to driveline and about some sort of tangible differences.
Sure.
So that got me excited about Nootbaar. Just reading a article on a website telling me someone went to driveline isn't going to take me from out to in, but I think with a guy like Taylor, I'd rather he go to driveline than not go to driveline.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I saw some quotes about him talking about going to driveline, and it was all framed in the way of him being like the anti-analytics advanced stuff, and going to driveline shows he has an open mind and is willing to adjust. I'm not sure that's true. It would be fascinating to see a study. Like if you could get a definitive list of everybody who's gone to driveline over the last decade, look at their like steamer projection and see if to what extent guys exceed their projected WOBA or fall short of it, or if it's just a random distribution and it's no different from the general population. Anyways, I like him regardless of how he worked out this offseason.
That story about him wanting to or not being an analytics guy and like kind of wanting to check it out reminded me of when Mike Matheny got hired by the Royals and was talking about all the like work he's been doing on studying analytics and stuff since he got fired from the Cardinals. But
I guess my guess is if it's good enough for Clayton Kershaw, it's good enough for him. It's like, Clayton Kershaw is willing to suck it up and go to driveline. Who am I to say no?
All right. So now you got to go first with a fade from this.
And again, I like most of the guys here. I want to talk about Kelenic unless he's your fade afterwards, because I'm curious on your take on him. He's not my fade. That feels too lazy. My fade is to make a point is Eric Haas, in the sense that I think the difference between Haas here and the 20th and the catcher you get. And I get this is DC ADP. I'm talking more for live events for fab events. And the catcher you get for free in the 29th to 30th round isn't enough to give up on the player that I can get on a young who I'm not getting in the 30th round. So it's not that I dislike Haas so much. I just don't think he's giving you enough of a push at catcher as opposed to just streaming crappy catchers until you land on somebody that he's worth using a 20th pick, which is still a really important pick to me. To me, he's really interchangeable with a lot of other catchers going much later. So he's my fade here. Don't take a catcher right here unless it's a catcher that you really think is helping you, and I'm just not convinced he is.
Yeah, no, I think Haas would have been my fade too. 100% agree with everything you said. I'll pivot over to Nationals' Luis Garcia here.
I didn't know which Garcia it was, so I was too sheepish to ask which Garcia are we talking about at this point. So I couldn't even consider him for my fade because I just didn't know who we were talking about here. Sorry, Luis Garcia.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a boring profile to me. Terrible team. So on the one hand, his playing time should be kind of safe, but I just think even in a best case scenario, the runs in RBI are going to be really bad. There's not a ceiling here. Like the ticket to him having ceiling is him hitting 300 or something like that, but it's not via home runs. He doesn't hit the ball hard enough and consistent enough to have a power spike this year. And he's not going to run much at all. So, just not a guy I would want in a middle infield spot. If you're not going to run that much at middle infield in this stage of the draft, I'm just not that interested.
There's so many good middle infielders. I know we're running not like Rob DiPietro long, but we're running long. But I really was curious on your Jared Kelenic take as the actual prospect guy. He's still so young. Like if he was coming If he hadn't made the majors for whatever reason, he's like, he could be on your prospect list this year. And yet now he's dead because of what he's done. Do you have any hope for it to come together this year or not?
Well, I wouldn't. I definitely don't have the type of hope that would be leading me to sort of proclaim that it's going to come together or anything. I would still bet against it coming together. But he's starting to kind of near the price where I think it makes some sense. You know, the batting average, the strikeouts, the aggressiveness, the pitch recognition, like all massive problems. But even amid all those problems, he's got 21 homers and 11 steals in 147 games as a pro. So that, and that's with him being a terrible player, and he's still got that power and speed. So I think if he's going kind of in the mid 300s, I think he's worth picking at this point. You know, in this range, like, I don't see myself taking Kelnick over Margot or Jorge Soler or even Jake Fraley or Chris Taylor. So like, he's not quite going so late that I would end up with him, but you know, I might take him over like Dylan Carlson.
An interesting Jared Kelnick stat, because he does have the 21 home runs and 11 stolen bases, which, you know, if you told me Jared Kelnick was going to get that in 2023, that's pretty good. So there have been 5,487 players in baseball history who have had at least 550 career plate appearances, according to Fangraphs. There may be some old-timey 1800s players that aren't in the Fangraphs database, but Fangraphs has 5,487 players with at least 550 plate appearance. Jared Kelnick, which Jared Kelnick is obviously one of them, he currently ranks as the 103rd worst BABIP of the 5,487 players. That's 1.9th percentile. Said positively, 98.1% of players have a higher BABIP than Kelnick. So Kelnick has both been horrendous to start his career. He's also been extremely unlucky. If you give Kelnick a league average BABIP, which was .290 last year, his batting average goes from 168 to .214. So that's not good enough. Like, that doesn't work for us, .214. But at least if it's .214, his batting average right now, instead of 168, if you assume all the BABIP is luck, he's fast enough. Like, I don't think there's any real reason to think it's not mostly luck. 214, then you're like, wow, if you can just reduce the strikeout rate by like 3-4%, suddenly he's like a 230 hitter, and suddenly he's within range. So I'm not trying to be pro Kelenic, but I do think you also have to appreciate that he's been terrible. There's been some positives, and he's been really unlucky. He just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and I, you know, Trent Grisham's a guy going in this round, and I think over the exact same amount of plate appearances, I think those guys would put up very similar lines, and I might even take Kelenic for more power, maybe Grisham a bit more speed. But obviously, you feel better about Grisham's playing time, at least early in the year. And there's talk that Kelenic, you know, Kelenic, if you take Kelenic, I think you should expect him to strong side platoon early in the year, at least. They do have some guys they like to play against lefties in the outfield. So, you know, I was, from being completely out on him last year, I know you were as well. He's starting to drop to the point where he's kind of back on my radar.
I think the other reality, if you're drafting Kelenic, is he's a 2-for-23 with 9 strikeouts away from being in the minors again. Like, they're not, they're no, but I'm being realistic, is the Mariners are too competitive right now to let him work it out at the majors. I think it would not surprise me if he has a bad spring that he starts in the minors. I don't think they're going to let him work it out anymore. I think he has nothing to prove, but at the same time, he hasn't proven anything at the majors. So I also think his downside is he's Joe Adell, and he's just not good enough right now to play in the majors, for better or for worse.
Yep. Definitely possible. So
let's end on that happy note there, James.
I really appreciate you coming on, Rob. Can't wait to get some beers in the Mirage here in about 6 weeks. Sure. It's gonna be a blast. Why don't you tell people about the podcast that's getting started?
Yeah, like Rob DiPietro came onto your podcast last week, announced to the world that he's our new host, and Jeff and I had really no choice at that point today to accept the fact that it's reality. No, we're back tomorrow, so we're recording right now. For those listening to the pod down the road, we're recording on Wednesday. We are recording the first launch angle of 2023 with Rob DiPietro hosting us on Thursday. So check wherever. If you're subscribed to the Launch Angle, you are already subscribed to the new Launch Angle. If you have not subscribed to the Launch Angle, check us out. It'll be a lot of fun.
Thanks
and
so much.
And it will not be 6 hour pods. We have 2 hour gaps. So Rob's going to really have to adjust his style for us. And I know we've gone pretty long now. So I'm a bit of a hypocrite. And I know I spoke for like 92% of the time here, but we're going to keep it tight once we go to launch. Like, I got it all out of my system today, so tomorrow I have nothing left.
Oh man, I'm so thankful that you took so much time and shared so many good thoughts, and just love chatting with you whenever I can. So hopefully see you here in about a month and a half, and
cannot wait, my friend, for sure.
Well, thanks, buddy. All right. I'll be back next week with another guest, and the pod continues on. We're back to 5 days a week. So stay tuned for more RotoWire Fantasy Baseball podcasts brought to you by Underdog Fantasy and Fantrax.